You're listening to the Product Podcast from Product School, featuring the best product leaders from Silicon Valley and beyond. If you're an aspiring product manager looking for your first PM role, or an experienced PM looking to level up your skills and advance your career, visit productschool.com to learn about our certifications and how we'll get you there. This episode is brought to you by Amplitude, the pioneer in digital optimization software that helps product leaders answer the question, how do our digital products drive our business? 1,400 plus customers, including Atlassian, Instacart, and Under Armour, rely on Amplitude's product analytics. Get started at amplitude.com. Today, we are pleased to welcome Google Product Manager Anurag Viswanath to the program. He will be sharing some fabulous mental models that will guide you to making better decisions for your product. He will cover everything about mental models and how to use them so that you can navigate the ambiguity that is so common in the decision-making process.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this webinar hosted by Product School. My name's Anurag, and I'm a product manager on the Hotels platform team at Google. Today's session is going to be a high-level introduction to mental models as a concept and how they can be leveraged for product decisions. Here's a quick preview of what we're going to be covering today. I'm going to start by talking about what mental models are and why they're useful, then move on to discussing the different types of mental models that are relevant for product roles. And the last piece we'll cover is to look at a few examples of leveraging mental models in a product setting. We'll wrap up with some resources for additional reading for those who would like to dig into this topic further. And my hope is that you leave today's webinar with some new mental models and a better understanding of how you can use these to be a more effective product manager. So what are mental models? Let's take a quick look at what they mean. But before we jump in to look at how they're usually defined, a quick question for everyone here. Would you step in front of a speeding bus? Probably not. I'm guessing at least a majority of you lean towards no as a response, right? And this response most likely stems from your understanding of the potential consequence of that decision. Now let's park this question for now and revisit it in a bit. Now, with that example in mind, let's take a look at Wikipedia's definition. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to read the parts that are in bold. A mental model is an explanation of someone's thought process about how something works in the real world, and they help shape the behavior and set an approach to solving problems. I'll let that sink in. It might seem a little verbose, right? Now, let's look at an alternative definition. And this is how I think about them. Mental models are thinking tools or frameworks that are typically used in conjunction with each other to help arrive at the most rational decision based on the information available in a given context. It's important that I call out that this is an oversimplification of the concept, but it tries to capture the main essence of it. The term mental models is sometimes an overloaded term, but I think of them as a superset of concepts, frameworks, tools, whatever you want to call them, that help me navigate the world in a given context, right? Both in a professional and a personal situation. Now, these aren't necessarily prescriptive, so I'd view them as guardrails to guide your thinking. A couple of points that are worth calling out here. While it might not seem obvious, most of you already think using mental models, either unconsciously or otherwise. For example, going back to the earlier question that I asked, right, of knowing not to step in front of a speeding bus, that's a mental model. Another simple example is gravity. You all know what that means in the context of, say, dropping a ball from the roof of a building, right? To put it differently, think of your mind as a pattern matching machine where mental models shape how you think, how you view problems with different lenses, and how you identify the information that matters and ignore what doesn't. Another visualization that helps me personally to get the concept is to think of it as your personal toolbox of thinking tools or frameworks. And so the quality of your assessment of a situation and your subsequent decision-making is a direct function of the number of mental models that you have in your toolkit, and more importantly, your ability to use them proficiently. So practice is key. Now, that said, there is no master checklist that will work for everyone. Rather, you will need to build and continually update your list of mental models, depending on your challenges, your needs, your context. All right. Now you might be thinking, well, that sounds great. Good to know about these, but how are they even relevant in a product role setting? Right. Great question. Let's take a look. Now, in a typical workday, product managers are responsible for making a wide variety of decisions, right? Both frequently and sometimes quickly. Variety and frequently being the key operative words here. Additionally, it's likely that they don't necessarily have all the data or the information that they might need to aid with either decision-making or problem-solving or whatever the case may be. And so the more models we have in our heads as product thinkers, the bigger the toolbox we have. Now, your typical decisions could range from, and again, I'm listing a few here, right? Could range from picking a strategy for accomplishing a product vision to prioritizing what is most important to build first. You might want to decide areas that make the most impact and potentially those that your team might want to divest from and so on and so forth. So mental models help with a lot of the situations that I just mentioned. They help reframe a problem and help you ask the right questions to look at it from a different perspective, because it's often important to get a strong understanding of the problem before you even jump into the solution space. Ideally, you want to be solving the right problem, and these tools can help identify potential blind spots in your approach. They help you make good decisions consistently. They help you strike a balance between risk, reward, impact, unknown variables, and varying perspectives in a given situation. They also help provide language to communicate the why behind complex decisions to your team or to your cross-functional stakeholders. And most importantly, and this is one of the reasons that I, you know, love learning about them, is they help navigate the ambiguity in the PM role, right? And then they reduce your day-to-day decision fatigue. Now, it's important to note that making the right choice is not a binary process. We aren't looking for perfect solutions, but instead, using logic and available data, we want to arrive at the best possible decision. Now, selection of the right tool and application of these mental models depends on a lot of factors, right? Like the stage of the product development lifecycle you're at, the decision velocity with which your team or your organization wants to proceed. It could be the fast or slow decisions. The nature of the decision itself, right? Is it a strategic decision versus a tactical day-to-day operating decision? So there are a bunch of factors that need to be kept in mind here. Here I've created a mind map of common thinking tools, and I view it as the PM toolbox, right? That I've found useful and that are applicable in a product setting. It's not meant to be exhaustive by any means, but instead it's my attempt to illustrate the spectrum of concepts or thinking tools that are available out there and that are to a large extent applicable to the product role in different contexts. Now it's likely, actually very likely, that you might already be using some or all of these or some variants of these. But the goal here is for those who might be new to this concept is to help you visualize the different types of tools, frameworks out there, and encourage research in areas you would be interested in. The way I think about these, there are four high-level buckets. The first is problem solving, and this includes tools like first principles thinking, issue trees for root cause analysis, and others. The second bucket that I like to think about these in is decision making, which includes a lot of your prioritization framework, right? A lot of your decision matrix-based techniques. Then there's a third bucket of systems thinking. And these, you know, tools help understand complex systems, the underlying components and how those components interact with each other, the relationships between them. And then there's the fourth sort of catch-all bucket, which contains a lot of the other tools, and I just call them the general bucket. I recognize that these could also be segmented based on which stage of the product lifecycle you might find use for these, but personally, I've found this bucketization to be a better representation as they can be applied for multiple use cases in a feature or product's journey. We'll look into a few of these in the slides that follow, but unfortunately, we don't have the time to dig into each of these. But however, for those who are interested, there are a bunch of resources out there for further research, and I'll link to these towards the end of the session. feel free to take a look. At this point, I would like to reiterate that there's no one-size-fits-all mental model. And what you choose to use would depend on what it is that you're trying to do in a given situation, right? Which could be understanding your customer's needs, scoping a feature, problem solving for known user pain points, identifying growth opportunities, prioritization, which falls under decision making, so on and so forth. Things like stack ranking, which is, you know, one form of decision matrix, if you think about it. The JTBD theory, jobs to be done theory, where it helps you understand your customer journey and the goal with their usage of a product, of your product. The 80-20 principle, right? Also known as the Pareto principle. All right, moving on. Let's quickly take a look at some of the popular thinking tools, frameworks that a lot of you might already be familiar with. Again, this is just a small subset, but I wanted to walk you through at least a few of the ones we saw in the previous mind map. So the first one is first principles. It's a powerful tool for problem solving that helps break complex problems into smaller chunks. And the concept here is pretty simple, right? It's that you dig deeper into a given problem until you arrive at the fundamental parts that you know are true. And then you create an effective solution from there. What it does it helps clear up pre-existing assumptions that no longer hold, right? Some common techniques that deploy this principle are the five whys technique, right? Or like ask why multiple times until you arrive at the crux of the issue or the root cause of the issue. The second one is Socratic questioning. It's a form of disciplined questioning to help you with critical thinking. And there are a bunch of questions that you can ask of varying nature, ranging from questions that are clarifications to probing assumptions and the evidence that you have at hand to the consequences that you think might come up to even questioning the question itself, right? The second one is risk scoring. And if I understand correctly, this is one of the most popular but simple prioritization tools out there. It helps quantify the potential value of a list of product features or initiatives that your team might be looking at. Right. And it's a type of decision matrix which utilizes a scoring system based on factors like, you know, R for each. How many people will your feature impact in a given time period? Impact, which is I, how much will this impact individual users? C stands for confidence. How confident are we in our evaluation of the earlier two scores? And then E stands for effort, which is the level of effort that will be required to implement a lot of these features that you're evaluating. And it's calculated as a score, and the formula is on the slide there. The next one that I want to quickly touch upon are reversible and irreversible decisions. I think I read about this in one of Jeff Bezos' shareholder letters, right? The first time I read about these. And the letter itself is from, I guess, back in 1997, right? So it's pretty old. And it's a simple decision-making heuristic that helps with execution velocity. So effectively, what the concept states is that if a decision is reversible and it is in high risk, we can usually make it fast and without perfect information, right? It's also sometimes referred to as a type 2 decision. A way to think about this is to visualize a two-way door, right? Your everyday operating decisions likely fall under this bucket.
This episode is brought to you by Amplitude, the pioneer in digital optimization software that helps product leaders innovate faster and smarter by answering the strategic question, how do our digital products drive our business? 1,400 plus customers like Atlassian, Instacart, and Under Armour rely on Amplitude's best-in-class product analytics solution to unlock insights, build winning products faster, and turn products into revenue. Get started at amplitude.com.
In contrast, an irreversible decision is one wherein we might need ample information to understand the problem better, right? Before we can figure out a way to move forward. It might require a different process altogether, right? A strategic decision, for example, is usually a type 1 decision, and it requires a lot more deliberation with your stakeholders. The fourth one on here is technical debt. And this is analogous to financial debt, but in a technical context. It usually refers to technical decisions that your team might make to hack something quick, to get things moving in the short term, but that might have long-term implications from product scalability or stability standpoint. It's not necessarily a bad decision. If the priority for the team is to get products shipped quicker, that might be the way to go. But it's definitely something that the product team and the Inch team need to recognize as a trade-off that they're willing to make, right? And it's something that you would have to revisit at some point in the future. The last one on here is the Eisenhower matrix. This has been one of my personal favorites, right? It's pretty simple. It's a useful prioritization technique from a task management standpoint, right? It can be used to triage tasks and actions as a PM. It's useful in the sense that it's simple, right? It's useful in slicing its simplicity. It's usually represented as a 2x2 matrix. You know, you have importance along one axis, urgency on the other, and it helps you bucketize different tasks based on where they fall on, you know, one of these four quadrants, right? So when can you use this? One use case that I think of and that I use this for is for when you're dealing with multiple stakeholder requests. This model can help you focus where it matters, right? It can help you learn when to say no, not how to say no. That's a completely different conversation altogether. But when to say no, when to delegate as required, and then when to cut unnecessary tasks that might not be, you know, worth getting to, relative to the other tasks that might be on your plate. All right. So we went over the PM toolkit, the mind map, and a few of the popular thinking tools in the earlier slides. Now let's take a look at a few tools that I find incredibly helpful whenever I think about my product area or a problem that I'm deliberating on. The first one that I want to talk about is called inversion. This is one of my favorite mental models, both for problem solving in a product context and also in my life outside of work, right? It improves understanding of the problem at hand. It's sometimes referred to as thinking backwards, right? But on a high level, it's the same concept. Now, what this concept states is that it helps you visualize how failure could look like, right? So this way, you as a product manager can better understand what needs to be avoided, and you can rework your strategy, your timeline, etc., accordingly. Now, in other words, it helps reframe and view a problem from a different perspective, and it helps you avoid possible mistakes or bad outcomes. So the steps involved on a high level are pretty simple, right? Step one is you define a product goal. What is it that you're trying to achieve, right? Then you invert it, and there are a bunch of questions that you can do, that you can use to, you know, come up with the sort of the answers that are required here, right? Questions like, what reasons would guarantee a failure at achieving this goal? What would be the worst decision or solution in this situation, right? Or what features would destroy this product? This can be a team exercise as well, right? Where you get your cross-functional team together, your bunch of engineers, your designers, and effectively brainstorm these factors and make a list, right? The third step is you just avoid these, right? It's as simple as that. So when do you use this technique? It's a pretty simple concept to grasp, but it takes practice to implement effectively. So it requires practice, and it helps you view a problem from a different angle. So one trigger question that I use is, am I only thinking of ideal solutions or scenarios? And if yes, then maybe it's an opportunity to look at the problem from a different angle, right? Potentially. This technique is important for when you're starting a new project or working on a high-stakes problem where you might want to focus on specifically avoiding bad outcomes, like bad solutions, right? Some other techniques used in the, at least across the tech industry that leverage this concept are sometimes called press releases or pre-mortems, but a lot of these on a high level leverage this concept of inversion. The next concept that I want to talk about is second-order thinking. Now, this is a useful tool for a variety of use cases, and it helps you examine the long-term effects of your product decisions. Now, first-order thinking is fast and easy. It happens when we look for something that only solves the immediate problem without considering the consequences. Thinking in first-order effects is often a dangerous oversimplification of a situation. Second-order thinking, whereas, is more deliberate. It involves thinking in terms of interactions and time, Second order thinkers often ask themselves the question, and then what? So here are the steps involved on a high level, right? Again, pretty simple to grasp, but as seen earlier when we were talking about inversion, it does require some deliberate thinking and practice. So the first step is you consider a decision that you have to make. You then start by listing down the immediate effects or the first order effects of making that decision. And then for each of the effects, you ask yourself, and then what, right? And hopefully for this exercise, you'll end up with a list of consequences that you hadn't originally thought of. And that could potentially help you uncover blind spots in your original assessment that could stem from your decision. Let's take a quick example to illustrate this further, right? Let's say you're the product manager on a social product and you're working through building a feature to help increase user engagement. Good. Now your team assumes that introducing it will lead to an increase in your monthly active users, assuming that's your product's North Star metrics. And then that assumption could be considered as your first order effect, right? You launch this feature, engagement increases, everyone's happy. Awesome, great. However, your second and subsequent order effects could potentially include, let's say, an increase in technical complexity, right? Let's say your server cost goes up, or it could go up in order to support this feature, or maybe it could lead to a degradation of the overall user experience, right? Over time, not necessarily immediately, but over time. While these aren't always bad, these are worth recognizing as trade-offs that you're willing to make. The next thinking tool that I want to walk you through is called eigenquestions. It's a relatively new concept in my PM toolkit. And I first came across this approach in a tweet by Shishir Mehrotra, who's the CEO of Coda, which is a document platform and was previously at YouTube. The concept is around the art of framing problems and asking questions. So what's an eigenquestion? Now, according to the folks at Coda, eigenquestion is a made-up word that borrows from the linear algebra concept of eigenvectors. Now, the basic concept here is that an eigenquestion is a question where if it's answered, it likely answers the subsequent questions as well. They illustrated this concept using an example of a teleportation device, which I feel is a great example to call out in its original form here, right? So I'll try to reproduce that just to further solidify this concept. Now, the question used in the example is this. A group of scientists have invented a teleportation device. They've come to you and asked for your assistance in bringing it to market. What do you do? At this point, most people will go into a question asking mode, right? They'll ask how big the device is. Does it need a sender and a receiver? How fast is it to operate? What does it cost? So on and so forth. At this point, the person who asked the original question then introduces a new constraint, which is, it turns out that these scientists are introverts and they are not enjoying all your questions. They've decided that they will only answer two questions. From those questions, they expect you to give a clear go-to-market plan. Now, given this constraint, what two questions would you like to ask? Now, one ideal answer would be to focus on these two questions, right? Which are, let's say the first question is, how safe is the device? Is it safe enough for human use or not? And where the primary cost is, right? Is it in operating the device, or is it a purchasing cost to acquiring them, etc.? Now, with only this information, they were able to describe four very different go-to-market paths. So you have, safety for humans on your x-axis, and then the cost on the y-axis, right? And depending on which quadrant you fall in, there could be a different go-to-market path that we could take. And this emphasizes my earlier point of finding the right problem to solve before even diving into solution mode, right? And as product managers, we sometimes tend to do that. But there's a lot of value in ensuring that you're solving the right problem. And a lot of the value comes from knowing what questions to ask to get to that right problem, right? So eigenquestions are a good tool to help you get there. To summarize, while it might take some time to master the skill of reducing loads of questions into one or two key ones, this concept is a valuable one, right? It helps in framing a problem, and it helps bring it back to its essence. And then once you have those one or two critical questions, it helps you create a path forward, right? So try it out the next time you're trying to get to the right problem that you and your team would like to solve. Given the time that I have, let's say this is the last tool that I want to speak about. This is, I read it as the OODA loop, right? And it's originally a military concept, and it was used by fighter pilots, and it still is, if I understand correctly. And it's an acronym for observe, orient, decide, and act. The way I think of it, the PM lifecycle can be considered as a OODA loop in some sense, especially useful for 0-to-1 products or disruptive features, right? And on a high level, it involves the following steps. So you observe, right? So there's a lot of data acquisition that happens when you're starting off looking into a new area, right? Data around product, around the market, around what the users or the customer needs could potentially look like. Then you move on to the orient stage, where there's a lot of strategic planning that goes into it. There's market positioning. There are a lot of discussions that need to happen, right? Then you decide. You see cross-functional stakeholder feedback, and then you sort of arrive at a decision, and then you act, right? You execute, and you build the product or the feature, and you do it fast, right? The key essence of the loop is to make a decision before your competitor does, and that's why there's some stress here on the execution velocity. To summarize, under the OODA loop concept, as a product manager for your product area, you would observe the situation, you would orient yourself as required, you would decide what to do, and then execute on that decision, right? And this repeats for each problem statement or product area that you're going to be looking into. Now, that being said, I want to acknowledge that this is likely something you all might already be doing in some manner or the other. But I found this to be useful personally in that it gives me a high-level structure when I'm thinking about a new problem space, and it helps ensure that I'm not skipping a step. With that said, here are a few resources that have been my go-to materials in my learning journey of mental models and their application in the product space. To wrap it up, I would say this is just the start, right? I would encourage you to begin by consciously using these models when problem solving or when making decisions. And in no time, I hope it'll become second nature, right? It's an iterative learning process like all things in life, so practice is key. And that's it for this session. I would love to know what are your go-to mental models or thinking tools. So please feel free to drop a comment below. I would love to hear your thoughts. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn if you'd like to chat more about this topic or connect in general. Thank you, and hope you found the session useful.
Thanks for listening to the Product Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, it would mean the world to us if you would rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Taking the time to write just a few sentences about what you love most about the show will help us improve it and reach even more product people around the world. And when you're done, why not reward yourself with some free product management content and resources over at productschool.com? Until next time, stay product-led.